Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, Epistles, and the final book in the Bible, the Book of Revelation. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain of the Carmelite Monastery at John Paul II Catholic High and John Paul II Catholic High in Terre Haute. Our guest and author of the series is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, we've been talking about the dispersion of the apostles into all parts of the world around 42 and 43, and we just talked about Philip and Nathaniel or Bartholomew. So you want to mention something about those two, and then we'll pick up James the Greater?
Well, as you mentioned, this occurred in 42-43 A.D. This was during the time of a great persecution that was started by King Herod Agrippa II. And it was during this time, of course, that one of the apostles was the first martyr, of course, James the Greater, which we'll come to in here in just a little bit. So far, we've talked about St. Andrew, the traditions that we know of him. We don't know whether this evidence, you know, is 100% true or not, but there are traditions that have come down to us. The next one we talked about was John the Evangelist, and then we talked about St. Philip, and then about Bartholomew, and we were just about ready to start talking about St. James the Greater.
Okay, now, there were two Jameses, is that correct?
Yes, we've had a lot to say about both of them, actually. St. James the Greater was the son of Zebedee and Salome, and brother of St. John the Apostle. He's called the Greater because he became an apostle before St. James the Lesser, at least that's one of the reasons given, anyway. He is said to have preached in Samaria, Judea, and Spain. As we have discussed, he was the first apostle to be martyred when he was put to death in Jerusalem by the sword at the command of Herod Agrippa in 44 A.D.
Well, we also encountered James the Lesser in our discussions as well.
That's right, we did. He was the brother of Jude Thaddeus and the first bishop of Jerusalem. He was also Jesus' cousin. First cousin, actually. He was from Nazareth. He is called the Lesser because he first followed John the Evangelist to distinguish him from the other John. That's another reason. In addition, he might have been called the Less because he was physically smaller than his relative. That's been put forth as a possibility. Or another reason is that maybe he was less important. So that's another reason. I've always thought that was probably more appropriate, that he wasn't as important as the other John or the other James. Tradition has it that he was martyred about 62 A.D. at Jerusalem by being thrown from a pinnacle of the temple, then stoned and beaten with clubs and fuller's mallets while praying for his attackers. Keep in mind now he was the first bishop of Jerusalem.
Pretty horrible death. How about Simon the Zealot?
Well, very little is known about Simon, but also referred to as the Canaan, after, you know, the land of Canaan. The titles might refer to him being zealous for the law. Some believe that's probably the most probable reason he was called Simon the Zealot. Or it could be, though, because he belonged to one of the Jewish revolutionary movements known as Zealots, although this is highly disputed by some scholars. He is said to have preached on the Black Sea, around the Black Sea, in Egypt, northern Africa, Britain, and Persia. He was martyred, but the location is uncertain. Some claim that he was crucified in Samaria. Others claim that he was sawn in half in Suenir, Persia, along with St. Jude. Still others claim that he was martyred in Iberia, or Iberia, an ancient name for Spain. Those are just all different traditions, and We're not really certain. In fact, there may be no truth in any of them as far as that's concerned.
And as you say, it's really hard to know much for sure about the apostles.
At least most of them, anyway.
Well, and then there's St. Jude.
He's also known as Thaddeus, and he was the brother of James the Lesser. Their parents were Cleopas, who died a martyr, and Mary, who stood at the foot of the cross with the Blessed Virgin Mary. Their mother, Mary of Clopas, wife of Clopas, is believed to have been the Blessed Mother's sister. At least there's one tradition that she was. Therefore, she was Jesus' aunt. And they, of course, James and Jude, were, first cousins of Jesus. He's said to have preached in Syria, Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia, of course, would be Persia, which is modern-day Iran, and probably Iraq, where Babylon was located, with St. Simon the Zealot, as renowned for exorcising demons from pagan idols. It has been speculated by Eusebius of Caesarea Maritima in his very famous church history that Jude carried the burial cloth to Jesus, now called the Shroud of Turin, to King Abgar of Edessa, now called Urfa in northwestern Turkey. As Anne Carroll tells the story in her Christ the King, Lord of History, the book that I use for my world history class at John Paul T. Catholic High School, she says, quote, King Abgar had been stricken by a dread disease, probably leprosy. He had heard of Jesus and his healing miracles. So he sent a message to Jesus, begging for a cure. When the message arrived, Jesus had already ascended into heaven. So the apostles decided to send instead the apostle Jude with the holy shroud, believed to be the burial cloth of Jesus. But it could not be brought and shown as a shroud, for all the people have a natural revulsion toward objects which have been in close contact with the dead. Therefore, before being brought to King Abgar, the cloth seems to have been folded and decorated so that it showed only the portrait-like image of the holy face of Jesus. This would explain why St. Jude is often depicted carrying a circular image of Christ. That is, the shroud, when folded up into a case with a round window that shows just the face. When Jude opened up the image to cure King Abgar, as the story goes, so it is said at least, both Jude and the image became radiant with light, hence the traditional flame in St. Jude's forehead. According to Anne Carroll's account, quote, Abgar was cured and baptized, and Jude established Christianity in Edessa. The shroud remained there, but in 57 AD, a persecution of Christians broke out. The portrait-like shroud was hidden away for safekeeping in a hollow place in one of the city gates, so well hidden that the very knowledge of the whereabouts was soon lost. It was not rediscovered until the 6th century when an earthquake damaged the walls and revealed the hiding place. By this time, Edessa was once again Christian, and the crowd was enshrined in its main church. Carroll goes on to tell us that the shroud came to be in the hands of the Knights Templar during the Crusades, and eventually ended up in the possession of the church in Turin, Italy. It's a long story if you trace through that whole story. According to traditional accounts, Jude was beaten to death with a club, then beheaded in Persia, sometime before the end of the first century.
Okay, violent deaths for each of the apostles. We don't want to forget St. Matthew, Ron. How about the tax collector?
He began as Levi, the tax collector. Nothing definite is known of his life, other than a little bit that the Bible tells us. After preaching in Judea, different traditions place his missionary work and probable martyrdom in Ethiopia or in Persia. The first gospel of the New Testament has, from the earliest time, has been attributed to Matthew, although many scholars have disputed this.
Okay, isn't it true that more is known about St. Thomas than some of the other apostles, except for St. Jude?
Yes, we know more details about Thomas and Jude than we do about any of the others who went outside the empire, that is, the Roman Empire. Thomas was assigned to India when the apostles were dispersed in 43 or 44 AD. This was a very difficult assignment, not only because of the great distance, but also because of the religious practices there were extremely incompatible with Christianity. Ann Carroll states that he went by a caravan to Taxila in northern India and worked as a carpenter in the court of King Gundafar. After several years, he was able to gain a few converts. But after he departed, barbarians invaded Taxila and his Christian community was wiped out.
Well, you said when discussing Mary's death and Assumption, Ron, that Thomas was brought back to Jerusalem in 49 or 50 A.D.
There is evidence that Thomas returned to Jerusalem at the time of the death and Assumption of the Blessed Mother and to attend the Council of Jerusalem. Then he returned to India. There would have had to been some miraculous involvement there because the distance was enormous. It would have taken a year for somebody to have traveled from India back to Jerusalem, or at least 6 months anyway, because you had to travel by sea and by land both. But nonetheless, by Ann Carroll's account, this time he traveled the recently discovered southern monsoon route directly across the Arabian Sea to South India. This is when he's going back to India after the Council of Jerusalem. He arrived on the Malabar on the southwestern coast of India, probably in the year 52 AD. She states that Christian tradition tells of hundreds of miraculous cures and thousands of conversions. See, he's on the western side of the lower part of India now. After 17 years, he moved across the southern peninsula to the opposite coast, over to the east side. He eventually arrived at Mylapore, which is near the city of Madras today. Nearby was a temple of Kali, the goddess of death. And according to Ann Carroll's account, one day in 72 A.D., he was attacked and killed with a spear by priests from the temple of Kali as he was praying in a cave on a hill. He was buried at Mylapore, where ever since Indian Christians have venerated his tomb. The Christian community he founded at Malabar survived for over 1,000 years until India was opened up to the West. I understand that descendants are still known as the Thomas Christians. There's a mountain named for him near Madras, where he was martyred.
Okay, we certainly don't want to forget St. Peter, the first head of the apostles.
Yes, we've come full circle, I guess. He was the most important of all Jesus' disciples, except, of course, for his Blessed Mother. We've had so much to say about him so far that we're not going to say a whole lot right now. But as we discussed, he was the brother of Andrew, who led him to Jesus. Jesus renamed him from Simon to Peter, from the Greek Petros, or Petrus, meaning rock, which indicated that he was to be the rock-like foundation on which the church would be built. His new name in Aramaic was Kephas, or Cephas, or Cephas. Traditionally, from the first, he was considered to be the first bishop of Rome, or what we call the Pope. He probably left Jerusalem in 43 or 44 A.D. after he dispersed the other apostles and worked his way to Rome, setting up local churches along the way. He returned to Jerusalem for the council meeting in 49 A.D., and apparently returned to Rome after that, or soon after that anyway. He was crucified, at least there's a tradition that he was crucified upside down in Rome, probably during Emperor Nero's persecution of the Christians, because he claimed he wasn't worthy to die in the same manner as Jesus, his Lord. I read the execution took place in 64 or perhaps 67 A.D., probably, or at least perhaps, together with St. Paul. There's one tradition that he and St. Paul were both executed, maybe not necessarily right next to one another, but during that same period of time, that same persecution. Later traditions claim that St. Peter's Basilica in Rome was built over his grave, which I believe was confirmed by archaeologists in the 1950s. St. Mark's Gospel is based on Peter's teaching because he was a close associate of Peter's.
Okay, what more can you tell us about Peter's grave because of the belief that St. Peter's Basilica was stationed there in a very unlikely place on a mountainside or hillside because it was to be directly over the grave of St. Peter?
I read a fascinating book many years ago by John Walsh called The Bones of St. Peter. In fact, I just downloaded it off of the internet here about several months ago and intend to reread it again. It tells of the efforts of archaeologists over the years to find St. Peter's tomb, which was believed to be located under a complex of mausoleums in St. Peter's Basilica that date between about 130 and 300 A.D. This would be down in the catacombs, you know, down below the basilica there. The underground complex includes several graves and a structure that may have been built to memorialize the location of St. Peter's grave. The complex was partially torn down and filled with earth in about 330 A.D. to provide a foundation for the building of the first St. Peter's Basilica during the reign of Constantine I, the first Christian Roman emperor. Though many bones have been found in the site as the result of two archaeological excavations back in the 40s, I believe it was, in the 50s, Pope Pius XII, who authorized one of the excavations, stated in December of 1950 that none of the graves could be confirmed to be St. Peter's with absolute certainty. However, they continued with archaeological digs and discoveries there, and following the discovery of more bones and an inscription, Pope Paul VI announced on June the 26th, 1968, that the relics of St. Peter had in fact been discovered.
Well, that was quite a wonderful announcement.
It's down below the high altar there in the Basilica, Peter's Basilica in Rome.
It's an amazing thing. You can go actually down the stairways to see it through a glass window. Well, what about Matthias, one of the apostles that's probably not too well known?
Well, as we discussed in an earlier session, Matthias was a disciple from the time of Jesus' baptism through to his death and resurrection, and possibly one of the 72 disciples who were sent out to preach and heal during Jesus' public ministry. This would have been in Judea rather than Galilee. He was chosen by prayer, that is, Matthias was chosen to take the place of Judas by prayer, and the drawing of Lot to replace Judas as the 12th apostle, according to St. Luke's account in Acts chapter 1, verses 15 through 26. No one has heard of him in the New Testament. No more is heard of him in the New Testament. And the various traditions are made more confusing because of the similarity of his name with Matthew's. Traditions place him preaching in Judea and later Cappadocia, that is in eastern Turkey, in the Caspian Sea area. According to traditional accounts, he was stoned to death in Colchis, Georgia. He was stoned to death in Colchis, Georgia around 80 AD. Another account has him preaching and being martyred in Ethiopia.
It's really too bad that we have so few historical details about the 12 apostles, where they went, but that's the way that it is.
Well, we pretty well exhausted what we know. I mean, people have written books, you know, on the subject and everything like that, but a lot of it, of course, is educated guesses, a lot of speculation and what have you.
Well, this brings us back full circle to St. Paul, who is such an outstanding of the apostles, who became an apostle later on by the direct vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus. What about St. Paul?
Well, to more easily pick up where we left him off, I'll provide a brief summary of St. Paul's missionary activity up until after the Council of Jerusalem in 4950 AD. Around the year 45 AD, Paul began his great missionary journeys to carry the gospel to the Gentiles. His first missionary journey was to the Middle East, accompanied by Barnabas. His second journey was to Greece. And the third was to Asia Minor, or what is today Turkey. We're going to talk about all of those. All these journeys are described by St. Luke in the Acts of the Apostles. In fact, Luke traveled as Paul's companion on several of his trips. Everywhere he went, he founded Christian communities, to which he later sent letters or epistles to continue the instruction in Christian doctrine, to encourage them and to solve controversies. As we've seen, and will continue to see as his story unfolds, he encounters frequent hostility and opposition, especially from Jews, and he suffered the scourgings, stonings, and beatings.
This brings us, Ron, up to date, sets the stage for St. Paul's second missionary journey.
Yes, it does. As I just mentioned, we've already discussed the first one, so now we're going to talk about the second one. After the decision was made at the Council of Jerusalem in 4950 AD regarding the Gentiles, the apostles and other church leaders selected Judas, called Barsabbas, and Silas, to accompany Paul and Barnabas to Antioch with the news of the council's decision. In other words, the decision had been made now, and now they're going to take the news back to Antioch, where all the trouble started in the first place. The decision was contained in a letter that stated, quote, "For it has seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things, that you abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from unchastity. If you keep yourself from these, you will do well." Farewell. What they're really saying there is that the Gentile converts don't have to practice the whole Mosaic law, which included 613 commandments, called the mitzvot in Hebrew, which are found, of course, in Leviticus and Numbers and a little bit in Exodus and a little bit in Deuteronomy.
And it was a big argument and discussion whether the Gentiles, the new converts, would have to follow the old Jewish regulations.
Yeah, the males are not going to have to be circumcised, and they're not going to have to practice all those dietary and sabbatical and purification and liturgical rites that Jews would have to practice.
It was a great time of decision.
Well, St. Paul was having so much trouble converting Gentiles because of that. St. Paul, of course, that's why he called for the Council of Jerusalem, is to try to get this burden lifted from his Gentile converts. Well, of course, the Gentiles at Antioch, when they brought the news to them, this is Antioch, Syria now, and elsewhere, of course, were delighted to have the burden of the Mosaic Law lifted from them. The messengers spent some time with the church in Antioch. Then Judas and Silas were sent back to Jerusalem, and Paul and Barnabas remained to teach and preach in Antioch. This story is told in Acts chapter 15.
Okay, you mentioned Silas. We don't know a whole lot about him, apparently.
He's also known as Silvanus. I think that's probably his Latin name. In the Acts, and Silas in the Pauline letters, that is St. Paul's epistles. As I just related, he was one of the two men sent to Antioch as representatives of the Church of Jerusalem, you know, to bring the news to the people at Antioch that they're not going to have to, the converts, the Gentile converts, that they're not going to have to practice all this Jewish Mosaic law. He accompanied Paul and Timothy at the beginning of their missionary activity in Macedonia and Achaia. That, of course, would be Greece. You find these stories in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, in Corinthians. You'll find the story in Acts, in several different places. With Paul, he was beaten and cast into prison at Philippi. You'll also hear Philippi pronounced Philippi. So I suppose I've heard it both ways on various programs I watch on television about, you know, these archaeological and historical kinds of things. So I suppose either one's okay. At Thessalonica, the two narrowly avoided becoming victims of a mob by escaping to Beroea, where Silas and Paul separated. His work was mentioned by Paul in a letter to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 1:19. And his name appears in the salutations of both Paul's letters to the Thessalonians, both 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. He's probably also the one named in Peter's first epistle, 1 Peter 5:12. He probably parted company with Paul at some point, since he's not mentioned later in Acts nor in Paul's other letters. But he is later associated with Peter in Rome, serving as his secretary and called his faithful brother.
Okay. Well, after working among the Christians in Antioch for a while, Paul and Barnabas went on their second missionary journey.
Yes, that's right. Their intention was to revisit each of the Christian communities that they had already established. See, on this first missionary journey, they went mostly into Asia Minor, which would be, of course, present-day Turkey. Of course, that's a rather large country, so, you know, they went over a lot of territory. Barnabas wanted to take Mark, the evangelist, with them, but Paul refused because he didn't think it advisable to take one who had refused to go on with them into hostile territory on an earlier mission. And Mark then, of course, returned to Jerusalem. We mentioned that a little bit during the first missionary journey. Mark refused to go any further, and so he returned to Jerusalem. That's a story I think it might be worthwhile discussing when we start our next session, that separation between Mark and Paul, the little problem they had there. And, of course, that caused the falling out between Barnabas and Paul, because it's believed that Barnabas and Mark were probably cousins.
Oh. And it certainly shows that even the earliest Christians trouble agreeing on everything. So it continues on down today. We have to try to be careful how we get along with each other. Well, to our listening audience, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.